If you own a vehicle with less than 200,000 miles and have an auto warranty about to expire or no warranty coverage at all, listen up. CarShield has a low-cost, month-to-month vehicle protection plan that covers more parts than ever. Visit carshield.com/audio to find out how you could pay almost nothing for covered auto repairs. Drivers who activate this vehicle protection today will also receive free roadside assistance, free towing, and car rental options at no additional cost. Get your free quote today at carshield.com/audio. That's carshield.com/audio.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I am Joe McCormick. And today we're going to be talking about some early voice synthesis machines. Rob, I actually got interested in this topic because last week when we were watching the Weird House Cinema movie, The Black Hole, I was thinking about Roddy McDowall's voice when he's doing a voice for the robot character who shares a lot of proverbs with the human characters. And I kept listening to his line delivery, and I couldn't decide if he was trying to do, quote, robot voice or not. He seemed to kind of dip in and out of it. You know what I mean when I say robot voice, where a character's playing a robot and they say things like this?
Well, of course I know what you are talking about, Joe.
I got kind of interested in the history of robot voice. I was like, where does that come from? And I was digging around a little. I'm sure there is a good answer on that, but I don't know. My short search didn't really turn up anything interesting. But it did lead me indirectly to what we're talking about today, which is, of course, we have the voice synthesis systems that are largely digital today. Before that, you had a lot of electrical and electromechanical systems for synthesizing human voices. But actually, there's an even earlier generation, which are the purely mechanical voice synthesizers before electricity even came into the picture. And that is what really stole my heart, especially one particular machine of this type that I'm going to talk about in the second half of this episode, I think.
Yeah, this is a fascinating topic, in part because look at where we are now, right? It's easy today in our internet age for just the average internet user to engage with various chatbots and generative AI, text-to-speech, and so forth. And you know, so we're able to interact with an artifact, a thing that reflects human will that has been designed to do key and telling things that have long been the hallmarks of human activity, artistic generation, creative writing, and conversation, and especially speech. And of course, it's easy nowadays to do that, right? To transform into audible or even video content what is either written by human or created with some sort of a chat bot machine. The results may be amusing, they may be disastrous, but we're in this age where the idea of the machine speaking is not in and of itself groundbreaking, or at least if it is groundbreaking or if it's amazing, it's a lower level of amazement compared to previous ages.
Well, as you say, it's very integrated into modern technology. So there's, Siri and Alexa, all these like home devices that speak, GPS devices for the car, that speak to you. But almost all of them are still the subject of amusement. If you actually pay attention to what the voice sounds like, like reading emotions into the voice that's telling you what to do as you're driving, that always makes me laugh because it always seems a little bit annoyed.
Yeah. What's Siri's whole deal? That sort of thing, right? You know, the other interesting angle on all of this is that our modern technological advancements here, or even some of the historic technological advancements, like they are kind of the echo of a more ancient longing for this sort of thing. It connects to something that's just fascinated us for a long time, the idea generally of non-human entities engaging in speech. And you could go absolutely wild chasing down the various divisions of this, right? The various myths, legends, and traditions concerning the speech of animals, plants, inorganic materials, supernatural entities, voices seemingly internal, but also external to our individual experience.
Though I would say there is an interesting thing about machines or human or automata or human artifacts in general when compared to imagining an animal speak or any other usually not speaking thing starting to speak, which is if you're talking about a machine that does it, that means somebody has to make that machine and somebody has to work that machine. And it kind of reminds me of the idea of grammar in language. You know, the interesting thing about grammar is that when we use language, we all use grammar. So we have an intuitive grasp of the rules of grammar, but without serious study, people can't actually tell you what those rules are. And so, like, you know, that had to be, in a sense, a science to back engineer the rules of grammar that we use intuitively to, like, make them systematic and, you know, actually discover what those rules are. The same thing could be said about the phonetic rules that produce the intelligible speech. We can all do it if we can speak, but we don't necessarily understand what the individual physical properties of a word are. And so we wouldn't necessarily know how to make that same word come out of a machine.
Yeah, there are all these things that you have to deconstruct before you can attempt to reproduce it artificially. And we see that time and time again with in robotics, for example, you know, things that we take, you know, for granted concerning human movement and just about anything else you could imagine. It becomes so much more difficult to try and reproduce that. You've got to understand what it actually is on an entirely new level first.
Now, I am to understand that before anybody actually made a machine that could approximate or synthesize a human voice and produce intelligible speech, people were thinking about this as a concept.
Yeah, yeah. And this is not surprising. You know, this is kind of the meat of science fiction, right? Before we can do it, we dream of it one way or another, no matter what our exact grasp of science happens to be. It always reminds me of that that line in William Gibson's Neuromancer, where the character has made a deal, a pact with a powerful AI, and it's pointed out, like, this is the sort of thing that in centuries ago, people only dreamed of, making a deal with a devil. And now we've made it possible through our ingenuity and invention.
Congratulations.
Yeah. So, narrowing down here into generally the realm of alleged human creations that through at least partial technology, but also sometimes wizardry and alchemy and other things that are kind of like, you know, bunched in there together with actual technology to create some sort of a device capable of speech. And then there are some related things that are tied in there as well. And a lot of it comes down to the idea of a head, an artificial head that speaks.
I found something so loaded and revealing about that as a fact, the history of these machines. So many of them had, whether real or imagined, these machines, so many of them early on had heads or faces. So, like, it wouldn't just be a speaker like you would have today that's, you know, it's just a mechanical device for making the sound. It's like that the presence of a head or a face was considered important or at least desirable.
Yeah, and I wonder to what extent part of it is just an echo of these earlier ideas. So going to run through a few of these here. One of the most famous, mainly from a literary tradition, as we'll discuss here, is the idea of the brazen head. And there's more than one brazen head. We can say brazen heads, artificial heads that could speak. Basically a lot of these stories concern 13th century English philosopher and Franciscan friar Roger Bacon, who's come up on the show before. Though this particular version of the story doesn't seem to emerge until the 16th century, and it does so within the works of contemporary drama.
I think we talked about Roger Bacon at length in an episode we did about the invention of fireworks, which may come back and feature again in the feed soon.
Yeah, I believe you're right. Yeah, I think Bacon did come up in that. He had a reputation as not only a very learned man in both natural philosophy and theology, and I should drive home, definitely existed. I don't think there's any doubt that there was a Roger Bacon.
Oh, no.
But then there are all these other stories that he was also potentially a wizard who was capable of producing fabulous automata, either through amazing feats of clockwork ingenuity that I think would many would say was ultimately impossible during his time period, or failing that, he was into alchemy and, of course, dark, dank necromancy.
I think the way I conceive of Roger Bacon is that he, of course, was a real figure. He was of great intellectual note and significance, but much about his sort of general reputation is kind of legendary, if that makes sense. I mean, there are many things we know about him that are true, but there's also just sort of an aura or a vibe about him that is not really based in reality.
Yeah, I mean, he becomes a character in literature, especially in these accounts. So you can sort of look at the different phases, like historic individual ideas and, misunderstandings of said real-life individual, and then eventually that echoes into the fictional version of the person.
Which, that's the more like wizard version.
Yeah. And so there are a few different examples of this. This was like a popular motif for a while. There's a 16th century prose romance titled The Famous History of Friar Bacon, and it tells of Bacon trying to give a replica of a human head speech and having to call in the devil for help.
Cool.
Other versions of this tale describe it as an artificial head given life by demons, which was capable of spontaneous speech and, of course, telling the future.
What else would you tell?
Right. Robert Greene's 1630 play Friar Bacon and Friar Bungay mentions this several times, citing, quote, Bacon's necromantic skill and heads of brass that, quote, can utter any voice. The idea that's explored in both of these works is that Bacon wished to build a wall of brass around Britain with the help of the brazen head. He fails and the head explodes.
Why have I never heard this cited as like an early science fiction tale?
I don't know. I'm probably not doing due diligence on exactly what happens and everything. It's like saying, well, in Star Wars, the bad guys make one planet to blow up another planet, and then the planet they made blows up. You know, that's really skipping over a lot of the nuance. And so I think there's inevitably more nuance here, but I didn't get into it.
Okay.
So this idea of the satanic brass head of Roger Bacon persists, despite the fact that there's no indication that anything like this, even created purely through technology and not satanic wizardry, was part of Bacon's world. He was interested in optics and certainly various instruments, scientific instruments of brass of the day, but there's no indication that he ever built an artificial head and tried to get it to speak.
Okay, so this is part of the wizard aura, not part of his biography.
Right. Though, we have to drive home to, is it possible that Roger Bacon, as a hobby, did what he could to create, it's possible. It's not, I don't think he would have gotten it to speak, but there are various sort of ways you could interpret this as having some basis in reality that doesn't involve magic or super science of the day.
Okay.
Now, I went to my bookshelf and I pulled off my dusty copy of Brewer's Dictionary of Phrase and Fable. It provides a little more insight on the legend. Quote, it was said if Bacon heard it speak, he would succeed in his projects. If not, he would fail. His familiar, Miles, was set to watch, and while Bacon slept, the head spoke thrice. Time is. Half an hour later, it said, time was. In another half hour, it said, time's past, fell down, and was broken to atoms.
To atoms?
It's to atoms, yes.
Surely atoms means something different here. Atoms had not been discovered at the time. I think it must mean like pieces. Small parts or something. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. That'd be hilarious if it was literally broken to atoms.
Yeah. So I don't know if it works, though. It sounds like it's kind of an alarm clock that explodes.
Well, but I don't understand the difference between time was and time's past. They're both past tense.
That's a good point. Time is. Time was. Times past. It seems like you would want the present in there somewhere, but
yeah,
that's what it allegedly said, and you'll find woodcuts that have this motif on them as well.
like, it would make more sense if it said the three things were time will be, time is, time was. But this seems more like time is, time was.
Now, Brewers notes that references to the brazen head are just common in literature, appearing frequently in early romances, but with Eastern origins, though it doesn't get into that a lot. Elsewhere in the volume, it's also noted that artificial heads that speak occur elsewhere as well. And some of these are brazen heads and some of these are other things, but they're kind of, I think it's important to run through briefly some of these examples because they kind of paint a picture of not only some of these other ideas of artificial heads speaking and telling the future, but related non-technological, non-artifacts that kind of help inform what we think technology can do.
Okay.
Okay, so one of them is a brazen head in the possession of Pope Sylvester II in the 10th century, which he also constructed, and misinterpretations of its utterances could prove disastrous.
Oh, is this also believed to be satanic in some way?
I didn't go too deep on satanic implications, but possibly.
I guess it would depend on if this legend is associated with pro-Pope Sylvester or anti-Pope Sylvester sources.
Right, right. But you can definitely see that they're in the head itself, regardless of what's supposed to be powering it, like this, it ties into to oracular traditions, you know, mm-hmm. the idea that here is this thing that can give you cryptic wisdom if you have the wisdom to decipher what it's telling you. Another example that's brought up in Brewers is the Colossi of Memnon, which we did at least a whole, I can't remember if it was one episode or multiple episodes, but we discussed this on Stuff to Blow Your Mind. This is a fascinating topic in and of itself.
This was basically, a statue or a pair of statues, part of sort of a ruins complex that was famous in Roman Egypt basically because it would make sounds, and there were different theories about how it made sounds and why.
Yeah, yeah. It seems like, I think some said it was capable of speech, but generally it's described as singing or some sort of a note. And as we discussed, while there are some, I think, unlikely theories regarding the use of some sort of intentional sound-generating device or devices, it seems like a more likely explanation would have to do with peculiarities of the stone as it heated in the sun and then cooled at night.
Hmm.
Anyway, go back and listen to that episode if you want to know about them. They have a pretty fascinating history.
We'll remember better in the original.
Yes. There's the head of Orpheus at Lesbos predicting the doom and death of Cyrus the Great. However, I believe this is generally thought to be the actual head of the hero Orpheus after he was torn apart by the maenads of Dionysus during a bacchanalia for the sin of worshiping Apollo or having worshiped Apollo. I'm not sure what the exact charge was, but still a prophetic disembodied head that still continues to speak. Brewers also mentions the head of Minos, brought by Odin to Scandinavia, which I didn't know what to make of this because Minos is, of course, the mythical king of Crete that we've discussed on the show before as well. I think the actual figure in reference here might be Mimir, the god of wisdom that is beheaded in the Aesir-Vanir War. Odin claims this head, and it continues to speak secret wisdom. Again, this is another one. It's not a mechanical head. It's the head of an actual defeated divine being that continues to live on and to speak.
Mm-hmm.
There are tales of Albertus Magnus having an earthen head, which during the 13th century was said to speak and move until Thomas Aquinas breaks it by accident. And Magnus says, "There goes the labor of 30 years. Because now it's broken." So I don't know what to make of that one either completely. But again, we see this motif of a fabulous artificial head that speaks that manages to break one way or another. Either something fails, somebody knocks it over, or, you know, it explodes after you hit the snooze alarm twice. Then there's Alexander's statue of Asclepius, the Greek god of medicine, that was said to speak. But Lucian wrote that the sounds came via a concealed man who spoke through tubes. So here's an example of some sort of a creation. I guess it depends how you look at it. Either a statue that is intended to speak or through supernatural machinations speaks. But according to Lucian, it's neither of those. It's just tubes and some guy like hiding in the bushes speaking through the tubes, which is still clever and still technological, but is trickery nonetheless.
I think the Lucian you're alluding to there is Lucian of Samosata. Is that right?
I believe so, yes.
Yeah, this was an ancient satirist from Syria who is quite hilarious and was kind of a skeptic debunker of the second century CE, which is sort of strange. But he was in that mold, and he made like vicious mockery of people of all sorts and different philosophies and stuff, and also wrote a satire that some people have considered one of the earliest forms of science fiction.
Oh. Now, this also reminds me, this is not, I mean, I guess it, if memory serves, maybe it did speak, but there was, of course, the man-faced serpent god Glycon of the second century that is often held up as being a hoax. Like, it was actually a puppet, according to commentators. But I've always wondered what to make of that, because it kind of, if someone is performing puppetry and people are having an emotional or even religious reaction to it, it kind of depends how it's presented, right? Are you presenting Glycon, the man-faced serpent, as like, this is it. This is an actual man-faced serpent god. Come take a look. Its life is proof that he is real. Or is it something else? Is it more like performance? Or is it more like reinterpretation? Yeah. You know, because you have plenty of examples where people will carry out performances in which people dress as divine and semi-divine figures. It's not supposed to be like, look at the proof. Here is this hero on the stage. This means God is real.
Funny enough, I think Glycon was also written about by Lucian of Samosata. But I guess the crucial question is like, is there an attempt at trickery or not? Like, do you want the audience to believe there is not somebody behind the mask?
Right. And, you know, that's interesting because that still kind of applies to a lot of what's going on in the world today with things like chatbots and so forth. And, you know, this idea that if we, you know, that what is coming out of the box, what is coming out of the artificial head, and, you know, how are we interpreting it? And are we thinking there is something there that is not? So it's like, on what level is there trickery? And then there is like interpretation of the trickery and so forth.
Hmm.
But at any rate, I think, you know, some of these examples, they prove that well before people could make any kind of a mechanical thing, be it a head or not a head, that could speak, we were still capable of dreaming about it. And I think there's ample evidence that long before anyone attempted to make a head that could talk through mechanical means, individuals sought and sometimes found a voice emerging from disembodied heads, either real ones, the remains of human beings or other animals, or likenesses of human heads, either attached or detached from statues and so forth. And I think there's room between trickery and belief, you know, for the suspension of belief and ritual as well to take into account.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
Western nations like the U.S. and Europe.
Mexico will likely have its first female president.
And then you have China.
And help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters.
He'll get his yo-yos to Europe in time. But the longer this drags on, the more worry he's getting.
They knew that they needed to do this as fast as they possibly could to get a drug on the market as fast as they could.
I'm David Gura.
I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets.
basically everyone was expecting, if not a calamity, certainly a recession.
But the problem is that that paperwork, as our reporting showed, is fake.
As someone who's covering the market, I'm often very worried about an imminent collapse. So I'm thinking about it quite often.
Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters.
It's an election year, so there's a lot of focus on the voters that TikTok is reaching.
The initial reaction is like, oh, things are looking so resilient.
I don't want to be too pessimistic, but I just don't see the political will down in Washington right now to change their tune.
I think the American electorate has been signaling that it expects a rematch of the 2020 election. These are unprecedented times.
With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
But of course, later on, people would end up building real operable machines that were at least attempting to produce speech that could be understood by humans.
That's right. And this is where we get more into the deconstruction of what human speech is, which in and of itself is a whole subject. But there are key moments where we see some major advancements being made here. So another major entry to discuss in all of this is the work of German-born Russian doctor, physicist, and engineer Christian Gottlieb Kratzenstein, who lived 1723 through 1795. So he was a man of various interests, including the use of electricity in medicine. And the St. Petersburg Science Academy at one point offered a prize for advancements made in researching the mechanisms behind the vowels, A, E, I, O, and U, in human speech. So in 1779, he presented his vowel organ to the university. The vowel organ consisted of a series of resonators that produced vowel-like sounds on a constant pitch when excited by a reed. I found some illustrations of these basic resonators via the UCL Psychology and Language Sciences department here. I also found a website linked at this website where you can find instructions for how to make your own resonators out of plumbing supplies, which I found rather insightful. I did not attempt it, but if you're into plumbing supplies and vowel sounds, it seems like a natural craft choice.
But the key insight being here that by changing the shape of a physical resonating cavity, you can change the sound of the vowel produced.
Right, right. Another take on this, I was reading the BBC Future article, The Machines That Learn to Listen, by Katia Moskvich, and it describes these as resonance tubes connected to organ pipes. So, you know, this is not to say that this is not on the same level as some sort of imaginary brazen head that's going to speak of its own and spit out wisdom for you to interpret. This is about just figuring out, you know, how these vowel sounds are produced and reproducing them through a basic mechanical system. Mm-hmm. Moskvich also points out a few other key individuals in the advancement of this technology. There's Wolfgang von Kempelen in Vienna, who created a similar acoustic mechanical speech machine about 10 years after Kratzenstein. And then she also mentions English inventor Charles Wheatstone, who would improve on this in the early 19th century.
Charles Wheatstone, I'm going to mention him again in a minute, but he's also notable because he was one of the inventors of the first commercially successful form of the telegraph.
Hmm.
So we talked about him in our episode of the telegraph. But when it comes to the one you mentioned before that, von Kempelen's machine, this is interesting because I read that while this machine was allegedly real, it was a real attempt to make a machine that would speak. Von Kempelen is now known for essentially being a hoaxer because he tried to create other automata, including a chess-playing automaton that was actually a hoax. It had a human inside it doing the moves, so it was a fake robot.
though as a fake, still really impressive. It's interesting where you get in, like, what sometimes you're wondering, you have to wonder what the line is between, you know, the actual technological innovation and trickery. I mean, obviously it's deception. And if you have a secret chamber in which there's a whole person doing stuff, you know, that's a real red flag there as well. But still, yeah. The trickery is pretty ingenious, too.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, it takes skill to be a good magician.
Yeah.
Anyway, this brings us to the example that I was really excited to talk about in today's episode, which is the speaking machine of a 19th century inventor named Joseph Faber. So one of my main sources here is just generally a good source on the history of speech synthesis and talking machines. It was a book chapter in the Routledge Handbook of Phonetics from 2019 by an author named Brad H. Story, who is part of the faculty of the Department of Speech, Language, and Hearing Sciences at the University of Arizona. And Story in this chapter traces the history of speech synthesis from the mechanical methods of the 18th and 19th centuries to the digital techniques of the present. So it's the whole sort of modern arc of these machines. But the thing I really want to focus in on here now is this machine that I mentioned a minute ago by the 19th century German inventor Joseph Faber. This features heavily at the beginning of Story's chapter here. So this machine was at various different times called the Marvelous Talking Machine. You got a hyphen between talking and machine. And also the euphonia, from the Greek meaning good sound or sweet sound. We'll see about that as we go on. Rob, I included one illustration of the machine for you to look at here. I think this may have been from some kind of promotional material when this machine was featured in an exhibit that I'll describe in a bit.
I love it, in part because right there is this angelic human face, right there on the machine, seemingly as like decoration or maybe tribute. I'm not sure, but I'm not sure if it's actually necessary to the mechanics of the device here.
I think it sort of is. I'll explain. So Story introduces Faber's machine through the eyes of another inventor and scientist of the day named Joseph Henry, a different Joseph, a researcher on electromagnetic induction and also the inaugural secretary of the Smithsonian Institution. Henry encountered Faber's marvelous talking machine at a private exhibition in Philadelphia on December 20th, 1845, and he described the demonstration in a letter to a colleague named H.M. Alexander. So we have contemporaneous notes on what it was doing and what it looked like in this private demonstration. So here's how it worked. It was controlled by an operator via mainly by foot pedals and a keyboard, essentially just like an organ, like a chamber organ. And in fact, the device could in some ways be considered a modified organ. So you had a foot pedal that operated a bellows, and that would supply airflow to the whole system. And the bellows pumped air through an artificial larynx that had vocal cords that were, in this source, said to be made of rubber. And this artificial glottis or artificial vocal cords would vibrate to produce the fundamental sound of the machine's voice when air was flowing through them. And then you had 16 keys on the keyboard, which were connected by strings and levers to the various components that controlled the shaping of that sound, of that, you know, the resonating sound from that airflow through the glottis into speech. One of the interesting things is, as we've been saying, this device actually had a face. So the face was made of carved wood, essentially a large doll head, but it had a hinged jaw. So maybe you should think of it more like a ventriloquist dummy. You're loving okay. This, aren't you?
Yeah.
Night of the Living Dummy, but it can actually speak. And so inside the dummy's mouth, there was an ivory tongue that could be moved around inside the oral cavity to control the shape of the resonating chamber. And by controlling these different elements, like the mouth and the tongue and all that, with the keys on the keyboard, it, quote, imposed time-varying changes to the air cavity appropriate for generating apparently convincing renditions of connected speech.
Hmm.
So it may not have sounded perfect or even pleasant, but apparently people in the room could understand what the machine was saying when Faber operated it. So this is 1845, and the machine is speaking intelligible words. Henry, in this letter, compares it favorably to a different talking machine, one he had seen years before. This was one of the ones you mentioned, Rob, the one built by the English scientist and inventor Charles Wheatstone, again, the telegraph guy. Wheatstone's talking machine was capable of being understood for the set of words it could produce. But Faber's machine was far superior because its speech repertoire was infinitely variable. So it could speak whole sentences, and those sentences could contain any words and any sounds you wanted, as long as they were in one of the covered languages. Obviously, it couldn't do, you know, like tonal languages or like speak Mandarin or something. But it seems like mainly it was speaking German and English. It was said at the time that it could speak any European language. Now, I think one thing that's really worth noting here is that if you imagine how a machine like this would work, the success of the performance would depend heavily on the skill of the operator, since the speech patterns are not like programmed and, not sort of expressed automatically, but expressed in real time by the player operating the bellows and the keys. And I think also there were some screws and stuff that would manipulate pitch and things like that. So you have to play this just like you would play a musical instrument. So different players using the same machine would probably produce fairly different sounding speech, even if they had memorized which keys corresponded to which phonetic units. So nobody I've read says this, but, you know, I'm kind of picturing Faber as a sort of Phantom of the Opera at the organ keyboard. You know, he's not just like pressing the keys, but giving a real passionate and dramatic performance when somebody yells out, yeah, make it say como tallevue or whatever. It also sang songs, by the way. I'll get into that in a minute, but I was wondering what are people asking? You know, what's the equivalent in 1845 of yelling out, play Freebird? And I was thinking maybe it's people are yelling for Tippecanoe and Tyler too.
Oh, yeah.
So an interesting detail that Story includes in this chapter is that this was not the first time Faber had built a talking machine. In fact, this was not the first time Faber had built this exact talking machine. There was an earlier version of it that was destroyed by Faber himself, quote, in a bout of depression and intoxication. I should say that nearly every source I read on Faber mentions something about him being disheveled or even haunted, obsessed with his machine, and generally emotionally unwell, or at the very least having a really rough time a lot of the time. Multiple writers describe him in terms containing a lot of pity. But so it took Faber apparently 20 years to perfect the first version of the machine, the one that he drunkenly destroyed. But he was able to recreate the second version within a year of that. And this kind of suggests to me the possibility that the original creation of the machine may have really been a project of fundamental research about phonetics more than it was about engineering. And so once he had the knowledge in hand of how each sound was produced, like what the shape of the oral cavity, how that corresponded to the sounds, recreating the machine itself might have been a relatively simple proposition. It's really what you needed was the knowledge about how phonetics correspond to physical shapes.
Yeah, and if he had that, and then certainly if he had notes on the matter and his designs recorded, it would be easier to come back and reproduce that.
Yeah. So Joseph Henry's letter about Faber's talking machine demonstration, it also includes speculation about the uses to which a machine like this could be put. One interesting idea he has is, what if you could take a spoken message at one location and code that spoken message into inputs on this keyboard, on this machine, and then through electromagnetic means, transmit those keystrokes across wires to a totally separate second location. And then those electrical signals could operate the speech organs of the doll-faced machine in the second location. You would essentially be transmitting speech itself across great distance. Notable that Henry's idea here is roughly 30 years before Alexander Graham Bell demonstrates the principle of the telephone. But there is a very important difference. which is that while Bell's telephone, and these are Story's words here, quote, transmitted an electrical analog of the speech pressure wave, Henry's description alluded to representing speech in compressed form based on slowly varying movements of the operator's hands, fingers, and feet as they formed the keystroke sequences required to produce an utterance, a signal processing technique that would not be implemented into telephone transmission systems for nearly another century. So the interesting thing about Henry here is that he's not just imagining converting the sound of a voice into an impulse that travels along a wire. He's imagining a coding process. It's put into code for the transmission and then decoded by the machine at the other end.
Wow, I can't help but try to imagine this alternate past in which, instead of early telephones, people all had this weird cherub head mounted on the wall that then speaks to you in this, I'm assuming, slightly haunting voice.
Oh, I'll get to the haunting voice in a second. But anyway, Story flags it as historically significant that this one invention had both succeeded in producing generally intelligible synthetic speech to people in the room with it, and it had inspired at least one onlooker to start considering ideas for the electrical transmission of low bandwidth speech from one place to another. But neither of these possibilities really went anywhere. Henry did not devote any more effort to musing about the electrical transmission. And Faber's machine ended up being a circus sideshow, almost literally. So after this, Faber needed money. And beginning in 1846, to get money, he signed on to demonstrate his machine for P.T. Barnum. Got to have something for everybody, even people who want a talking doll head operated by a disheveled German organ master. So Faber committed to exhibit the marvelous speaking machine for Barnum at the Egyptian Hall in London. This was like a general exhibition hall in Piccadilly, which hosted all kinds of shows. But I think especially in the latter part of the 19th century, it was known for showing like a lot of mountebanks and fraudulent spiritualist demonstrators. You know, I'll reveal to you that you're actually a reincarnation of Cleopatra. Lucky you. But by noting that, that's just a random thing. I'm not trying to cast aspersions on Faber, because I want to stress that it seems totally clear that Faber was no con artist. As best we can tell, his machine really did work. And when played correctly, it did really speak original sentences that people could, for the most part, understand. Though, one thing that emerges from reading descriptions of this is that coding intelligible information and sounding like speech are two completely different things. So it seems that a lot of people could tell what the machine was saying, but still they were not very impressed by what they heard. And I found a spectacularly evocative description of what the machine was like, recorded in a book called Instruments and the Imagination by Thomas L. Hankins and Robert J. Silverman, Princeton University Press, 1999. But the main thing here is that they're quoting a person who saw the machine in person in 1846, I believe, and then wrote about it in a memoir. But generally, the authors here, they note that there were like some satirical articles making reference to Faber's machine, suggesting, for example, that it could be used to replace the Speaker of the House of Commons. Yuck, yuck, those wacky politicians. But then they do kind of make a funny point, actually. They say, like, you could just program it to say order, order at 10-minute intervals.
Well, that's pretty good. That's funny today.
Yeah. But anyway, then there's a part of the book where they're including this evocative written account, which is from a London theater manager named John Hollingshead, who saw this machine in person when he was 19 years old and then wrote about it in a memoir or some book. But anyway, this is Hollingshead's account. The exhibitor, Professor Faber, was a sad-faced man, dressed in respectable, well-worn clothes that were soiled by contact with tools, wood, and machinery. The room looked like a laboratory and workshop, which it was. The professor was not too clean, and his hair and beard sadly wanted the attention of a barber. I have no doubt that he slept in the same room as his figure, his scientific Frankenstein monster. Note, I guess the novel would have only been a few decades old at this time.
Yeah, yeah. 1818 on Frankenstein there.
Yeah. Going on with Hollingshead. And I felt the secret influence of an idea that the two were destined to live and die together.
Oh, my God. This is pretty strong words.
Yes. The professor, with a slight German accent, put his wonderful toy in motion. He explained its action. It was not necessary to prove the absence of deception. One keyboard, touched by the professor, produced words which, slowly and deliberately, in a hoarse, sepulchral voice, came from the mouth of the figure, as if from the depths of a tomb. It wanted little imagination to make the very few visitors believe that the figure contained an imprisoned human, or half-human, being, bound to speak slowly when tormented by the unseen power outside. No one thought for a moment that they were being fooled by a second edition of the Invisible Girl fraud. And by the way, the reference to the Invisible Girl fraud, I believe, is about the many fake machines and fake automata that were actually worked by having a human hidden inside operating it. But going on, so Hollingshead says, nobody thought that there was an Invisible Girl operating this. It's clear this is real. He goes on, there were truth, laborious invention, and good faith in every part of the melancholy room. As a crowning display, the head sang a sepulchral version of God Save the Queen, which suggested, inevitably, God Save the Inventor. This extraordinary effect was achieved by the professor working two keyboards, one for the words and one for the music. Never probably before or since has the national anthem been so sung. Sadder and wiser, I and the few visitors crept slowly from the place, leaving the professor with his one and only treasure, his child of infinite labor and unmeasurable sorrow.
Oh, wow. That is a lot. I mean, he lays it on really thick about the sadness of the inventor here. And then also there's the idea of like, this was no hoax. This was real. And it was depressing.
Yeah. It's a weird mix of like pity, but real admiration, you know, that like there's something beautiful and honest and true about this machine and his devotion to it and the genius it took to create it. But also it makes everybody feel bad and nobody wants to look at it or listen to it. And everybody leaves feeling depressed.
Yeah.
Something about that struck me as actually quite poignant and meaningful. Maybe we can come back to that in a minute. But I did want to flag that there was one notable visitor who, coming back to the Invisible Girl suspicion, he did at first suspect fraud, and that was the Duke of Wellington. I was reading about this in a book called The Shows of London by Richard Daniel Atlick. And Atlick recounts that Wellington, when he first went to the demonstration, he was so impressed by Faber's speaking machine that he asked to be allowed to touch the keys with his own fingers, you know, so he could see that it was genuine. And then he did confirm that it was genuine. And then he insisted that he be taught how to use it. So Faber taught the Duke to play the machine in both German and English. And Wellington did get it. Like he could make it speak sentences in German and English. And he was amazed, writing in the visitor's log of the exhibit that the speaking machine or the euphonia was, quote, an extraordinary production of mechanical genius.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
Western nations like the U.S. and Europe.
Mexico will likely have its first female president.
And then you have China.
And help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters.
He'll get his yo-yos to Europe in time. But the longer this drags on, the more worry he's getting.
They knew that they needed to do this as fast as they possibly could to get a drug on the market as fast as they could.
I'm David Gura.
I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen. We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets.
Basically, everyone was expecting, if not a calamity, certainly a recession.
But the problem is that that paperwork, as our reporting showed, is fake.
As someone who's covering the market, I'm often very worried about an imminent collapse. So I'm thinking about it quite often.
Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters.
It's an election year, so there's a lot of focus on the voters that TikTok is reaching.
The initial reaction is like, oh, things are looking so resilient.
I don't want to be too pessimistic, but I just don't see the political will down in Washington right now to change their tune.
I think the American electorate has been signaling that it expects a rematch of the 2020 election. These are unprecedented times.
With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Faber's machine also got rave reviews in The Times, in the Illustrated London News. A lot of people looked at it and they thought that this is a work of genius. It's incredible that he's done this. But at the same time, audiences really were not into it. Barnum himself noticed that Faber's machine was not attracting crowds. It was not selling tickets and not generating revenue. And so eventually he took Faber's machine out of the Egyptian Hall in London and added it to a traveling exhibit that went around the English countryside doing performances. And from here, Faber himself seems to kind of disappear from the historical record. Some sources indicate that he may have died by suicide during this period, though that isn't known for sure. But after historical sources stop mentioning Faber himself, they still make references to his machine. Reading from Story here, quote, "Although his talking machine continued to make sideshow-like appearances in Europe and North America over the next 30 years, it seems a relative, perhaps a niece or nephew, may have inherited the machine and performed with it to generate income."
So maybe no matter whatever happened to him, maybe a relative with a little more showmanship stepped in and was able to, make at least some sort of an income off of it.
Yes, but then again, I'm struck by the strange, ironic sadness of this. This was actually a scientifically significant invention. He had done something kind of amazing, but it just never really went anywhere under his mastery. And then, maybe a relative was a better carnival barker, essentially, to perform with the machine and make some money off of it.
I mean, it reminds me of so many advancements in, say, robotics that we've seen over the years, where oftentimes, to a certain extent, unfairly, there'll just be one little clip of it that goes viral and people react to, be it some sort of, a human likeness with facial features that seem to be moving or operating in an uncanny way, or something like the various dog robots from Boston Dynamics, that are very impressive, but also may be interpreted as being a bit creepy. And so even though they're often examples of a real impressive technological advancement, setting aside actual applications, you can have a situation where something like that is not as comforting, not as entertaining as, say, an act of puppetry. Or even an act of just outright, maybe not fraud, but say a robot or a costume depicting a robot may be ultimately maybe more reassuring, maybe more fun compared to the actual thing.
Well, yeah, which may just be fun or may in fact be fraud, depending on what exactly they're saying about it.
Yeah.
But this is a great point, and it brings me to, I just wanted to mention a few of the general notes about the history of speech synthesis from the end of this book chapter by Brad Story. Story writes that, you know, while there are technological use cases for speech synthesizers, we've got a number of them operating in consumer technology today, and even before you had, you know, personal digital assistants and stuff, there would be use cases for speech synthesizers for example, people who have a disability that makes it difficult or impossible for them to speak. Another one is that apparently this was actually used by the Allies in World War II. There were some forms of speech synthesis that would allow covert coded transmissions of something like a phone call. So you could have a phone call between like FDR and Winston Churchill. It's not really a phone call. It's like a transmitted synthesized bit of speech. And so it's very secure, but it doesn't sound like the person talking. It sounds maybe more like the euphonia, kind of robotic and unnatural, and maybe mm-hmm. making the president's giggle a bit, or president, prime minister. But anyway, so what Story says is that a large number of these systems have actually been primarily used as research tools, as scientific tools for understanding the nature of human speech. It's by trying to reproduce human speech and failing at it that we come closer to understanding how speech actually works in the human body. But the second general observation that I thought is interesting, and this seems to be very much reflected in the Faber's machine example, it is much easier to create a machine that can speak intelligibly than one that can speak naturally. So that indicates that when we talk, there's actually more than one thing going on. Yes, we are conveying mental information coded in words, and the substance of that coding is phonetic. It's a series of sounds. But of course, you know, the ironic thing to people who are used to thinking about words as text is that the phonetic core of language long predates writing. So like the written text of a word is a visual code for the sound of the word, which is the code for its meaning. But anyway, so machines for hundreds of years have been able to produce more or less intelligible phonetic code. They can speak words and people can understand what the words are supposed to be. But it doesn't necessarily mean that people perceive these machines as speaking, because there's another important quality to speech that was not really captured by these early machines, and you could argue is still somewhat lacking in the best speech synthesis of today, and that is the natural character of continuous speech. These machines always produced speech that sounded stilted, unreal, alien. It was never something that would make you feel like you were actually being talked to, as much as sort of receiving a weird alien code in your language. Mm-hmm. And here I just want to read from the Story's chapter, quote, "As a result, synthesis often presents itself as an oral caricature that can be perceived as an unnatural and sometimes amusing rendition of a desired utterance or speech sound. It is particularly unique to phonetics and speech science that the models used as tools to understand the scientific aspects of a complex system produce a signal intended to be heard as if it were a human. As such, the quality of a speech synthesis can be rather harshly judged because the model on which it is based has not accounted for the myriad of subtle variations and details that combine in natural human speech." So to paraphrase, speech is so much more than just the words. And even if you can get the words right, there's still something that is lacking and is going to take a lot of work to try to capture.
Yeah, this is fascinating to think about, especially given what you mentioned earlier about it's the importance of speech synthesizer technology to aid people who cannot speak or have lost the ability to speak. One of the most famous, if not the most famous examples of this is, of course, the speech synthesizer used by theoretical physicist Stephen Hawking. One of the interesting things about his story with it, as I remember, is that just me mentioning it, you can probably sort of hear the voice, the synthesized voice of Stephen Hawking in your head. And I know that at some point, like that was, you know, an early system he got there. And later on in life, he could have switched the voice up. He could have changed the voice and I'm assuming could have maybe improved upon it. But by that point, he felt that this was his voice. You know, you can't switch it up. You know, this is how I speak and this is how I hear myself. So I always found that interesting, and especially when, and then you can compare that to some other cases like, you know, film critic Roger Ebert late in life, you know, could no longer speak, but had, I think, they had a more robust system put together based on samples of, you know, the great catalog of his own recorded speeches and reviews and so forth that they could draw upon. And then looking into the future, you have situations like James Earl Jones's Darth Vader voice, that being archived and prepared for, so that in the future you can basically have like a machine synthesized version of that voice that will stand in as a sort of one-to-one replication of what James Earl Jones did in life with the voice acting.
Hmm. Or at least so the proponents of the technology would say. I'm sure there would be critics who would say it's never going to be a one-to-one.
Right, right. And then, of course, there's also the argument specifically with Darth Vader here. Am I discussing this? But obviously, the case can be made that, like, well, we shouldn't reproduce, deceased actors' voices to continue a fictional role. We should employ new living actors and existing living voice actors who can do the voice. I think with Darth Vader in particular, you could make a strong case for that, because there are other voice actors who do officially voice act that character and do a great job with it. What does it mean if that individual's job is potentially taken by this sort of machine likeness of that voice that is authorized based on the voice of a retired or in some cases, you know, deceased individual?
Well, we're going a little off topic now, but I will say that I stand by what I've said before, which is I'm firmly in the camp that I prefer recasting with a different actor as opposed to using technology to try to synthesize the voice or appearance of an actor who, for whatever reason, cannot be present.
Right.
People have been recasting the same role with different actors for decades. That happens all the time. Like, what's the problem with it?
Yeah, I agree. I agree. But in some cases, is it possible that a role that's been established by a living actor could not be just masterfully redone by a clunky machine with the face of a cherub that is manipulated by a sad German man who needs a haircut? I think there's some potential there. Like, I don't know, the next James Bond, maybe?
This is the only film genre I'm interested in from now on. Yeah. High-tension espionage movies starring the euphonia.
So there you have it. The machine speaks. Obviously, we'd love to hear from everyone out there if you have thoughts on all of this. And certainly anyone out there who has, you know, direct experience with speech synthesizer technology for one use or another, write in. We would love to hear from you. Just a reminder.
The speech synthesis or speech synthesizer is one of the hardest pairs of words to enunciate. And I've had to say it so many times in this episode. I just want to be recognized, especially for the times I probably did it wrong.
Yes. Well, it's easy for the babyface machines, though.
Yeah.
At any rate, yeah, if you want to listen to other episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, you will find them in the Stuff to Blow Your Mind podcast feed with our core episodes on Tuesdays and Thursdays. Mondays, we do a listener mail. Wednesdays, we do a short form artifact or monster fact. And then on Fridays, we set aside most serious concerns to just talk about a weird film on Weird House Cinema.
Huge thanks to our excellent audio producer, JJ Posway. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Thank you.
something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And so are we.
I'm Tori Deal.
And I'm Anissa Ferreira.
The wait is over, guys. All Stars 4 is finally here.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
And we're going to be right here along with you fans, covering every episode on the podcast.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.